And it's birthday time, and boy, do we have a lot of them today. First, our local birthdays, most importantly, Barbara Biddle of Indianola, Dale Schaefer of Des Moines, Leroy Evert from Sioux City, and Danielle Butterfield from DeSoto. Happy birthday to all of you. Hope you're having a great day today. You are joined by a whole raft of famous people today on your birthday. April 29 is a good birthday day. Willie Nelson turns 91. Conductor Zubin Mehta turns 88. Comic Jerry Seinfeld turns 70. Actor Daniel Day-Lewis turns 67. Actor Michelle Pfeiffer turns 66. And for those of you who grew up with the Brady Bunch, you will be, I don't know, shocked, appalled, floored, delighted to hear that Eve Plum turns 66 today. And Uma Thurman, an actor that many of us know, turns 54. Happy birthday to one and all. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call. We're at 515-243-6833. We can get you on our list, and we need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now, here's Nicole with today's obituary.
And this morning, we would like to remember Mary Wilson. Mary Jane Wilson was 87 years old, entered into God's kingdom on Wednesday, April 24th. She was a beloved wife, mother, and friend who will be deeply missed by all who knew her. Mary was born on March 18, 1937, in Albia, Iowa, to her parents Charles and Mary Alice Monroe. She was united in marriage to Robert F.D.R. Wilson on May 28, 1955, at St. Peter's Church in Des Moines, Iowa. Spirit Lake, Iowa, was a home away from home for them and their family. She loved having family and friends come to the lake and enjoy the cabins there. Mary and Bob also spent time seeing the country by traveling in their motor home. They enjoyed visiting family and friends. Her memory will be cherished by husband Bob Wilson, daughters Becky, Penny, sons Bob and Larry, and grandchildren Adam, Alan, Rachel, Hannah, Jenna, and Jared. Great-grandchildren Avery, Sophie, Annabelle, Wyatt, Henry, and Wilson, and her sisters Betty, Sheila, and Christy. Mary is preceded in death by her parents, Charles and Mary Alice, her sister, Donna, and also brothers Billy, Robert, Charles, and Rick Monroe, nephew Mark Westlake, and also her in-laws. Family will greet friends on Wednesday, May 1st, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens. That's at 121 Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines. Massive Christian burial will take place the following day on Thursday, May 2nd, happening at 10 a.m. at the St. Mary's of Nazareth Catholic Church at 4600 Meredith Drive in Des Moines. Family will also have a private graveside service at the Glendale Cemetery at a later date. In lieu of flowers, please make memorial contributions to the Animal Rescue League of Iowa or the Spirit Lake Protective Association. A very special thanks to the staff at Bishop Drum Retirement Center for their wonderful care for Mary during her stay. And now, here is Twyla with more of today's headlines.
What about Weinstein's California conviction? Experts say it's unlikely to be affected by a New York case. This is about new movie producer Harvey Weinstein. A New York appeals court on Thursday overturned Harvey Weinstein's 2020 conviction for rape. The stunning move was prompted questions over what this means for his 2022 rape conviction in California, for which he is currently serving a 16-year sentence. A wave of rape and sexual assault allegations spanning decades against Weinstein began pouring in 2017, spurring a reckoning in the entertainment industry with the hashtag MeToo movement. The landmark New York sex crimes trial, resulting in the now overturned guilty verdict, signified what felt to many like a turning point. The second trial, this time in Los Angeles, came as the embattled movie mogul, 72, served time in New York. A jury convicted him of rape and sexual assault in the case of Jane Doe 1, who has revealed her identity as Evgenia Chernoshova. Chernyshova is now the only victim of Weinstein to obtain a criminal conviction against him. Weinstein is appealing the Los Angeles conviction, where he was found guilty of multiple counts of forcible rape, forcible oral copulation, and forcible penetration with a foreign object. Despite the similarities between the two cases, including witnesses who testified in both cases, legal experts do not expect ramifications of the 2020 rape and sexual assault conviction or appeals process, noting that different jurisdictions handle cases differently. At the center of the New York appellate court's majority argument was the judge admitting testimony from women who, with allegations that were not a part of the case, known as Molyneux witnesses. Some of the witnesses in the 2020 trial testified during the 2022 trial. However, California handles its witnesses differently. Michelle Simpson Tugel, a victim's right attorney and founder of the Simpson Tugel Law Firm, says different courts in different jurisdictions often interpret the use of other victims' testimony differently. She goes on to say, I think that argument is something like is likely being made in the appellate case in California, but that does not mean the same result will be true, and it really shouldn't impact it. Simpson Tugel said that with as many resources and access to attorneys Weinstein has, it would not be surprising if his legal representation used everything they could in seeking an appeal. They are likely doing what we saw with other high-profile defendants, going down every road and trying every angle to get him another bite at the apple and overturn the conviction, she said. David Ring, the lawyer for Chernyshova, said that they were confident the overturn would have no bearing on the Los Angeles conviction, but Chernyshova still feels disappointed in the decision. She feels badly for those victims who endured that trial and the subsequent appeals only to see the conviction reversed, Ring previously said. However, both she and I are confident that Weinstein's Los Angeles conviction for rape will be upheld. As the only victim who has now obtained a criminal conviction against Weinstein, she will continue to stand tall and do whatever necessary to obtain justice not only for herself, but for all victims. A jury in December 2022 found Weinstein guilty of the rape and sexual assault of Chernyshova. But the jury hung on several other counts, including accusations involving Jennifer Siebel Newsom, California Governor Gavin Newsom's wife. The jury said it was unable to reach a verdict on her claim and another woman's claim, with Judge Lisa B. Lynch declaring a mistrial on those counts. Weinstein was sentenced to 16 years after facing up to 18 additional years in prison. Lynch sentenced him to 8 years for forcible rape, 6 years for forcible oral copulation, and 2 years for forcible penetration with a foreign object. She also rejected a motion by his lawyers for a new trial. Few lawyers anticipate the reversal of Weinstein's New York case to lead to other Me Too convictions being revisited. I don't see this decision having a precedential impact on other cases, said Niema Romani, president of the Los Angeles-based West Coast Trial Lawyers. For one, it was a slim majority in the New York case, a 4-3 decision, and New York law does not control California and other state laws. What the decision may have bearing on, Simpson Tugel said, are victims of sexual violence. There was a lot of momentum behind this case, and if this conviction can be overturned, I think of my clients who are the only survivor who may have come forward against an abuser, when so many survivors who have so much behind them are seeing this overturning of a conviction after a really long road, she said. That's extremely hard for the survivors of Weinstein to see, but also for survivors around the country, she said. However, much of a blow is dealt by the decision. She continues to encourage clients to seek justice. Just speaking out, they create change, and I think the survivors have done that, regardless of whether he's convicted in New York or not, she said. And he still has the conviction in California that's over his head, so that's not free, she added. Weinstein is currently housed at the Mohawk Correctional Facility in Rome, New York. He returned to New York last year after having been extradited to California to face charges there, according to the Associated Press. Weinstein will now likely be transferred back to California to serve the remainder of his sentence for his conviction of rape in 2022.
A quick local headline I found on the online version of the Des Moines Register is an Ankeny doctor, 73 years old, sentenced to 50 years in prison for sexually abusing a child. This is from Beyond Beyond of the Des Moines Register. Dr. Lynn Lindemann, a longtime Central Iowa surgeon who in February was found guilty of sexually abusing a child, was sentenced to 50 years in prison. Lindemann had a previous conviction of a sexually predatory offense, admitting that he was previously convicted of lascivious acts with a child in 1976 in Johnson County. This is according to a news release from Polk County. But because of his prior record, Lindemann, who's 73 years old, must serve a minimum of 42 and a half years. Lindemann practiced at the Lindemann Orthopedics Clinic in West Des Moines until he was charged last year with second-degree sexual assault. Police say that he inappropriately touched a child under the age of 10 at his home in Ankeny. He also faces a civil lawsuit from Sherry Moeller of Eldridge, the victim of the 1976 assault, filed last year under a 2022 law lifting the statutes of limitations for sex abuse victims to sue their assailants. She alleges that in July of 1975, when she was 14, she attended a gymnast summer sports camp at the University of Iowa, and Lindemann, then 24 years old, a counselor and athletic trainer at the camp, sexually assaulted her while treating an injury to her back. He was arrested and convicted on February 26, 1976, of lascivious acts with a person under the age of 16. Trial for this lawsuit is scheduled for May of 2025, and the Iowa Board of Medicine has now revoked Lindemann's medical license.
And moving now to Nation and World from USA Today, investors less forgiving of earnings setbacks. This is Dateline New York, and it's a story from Reuters. Richly valued U.S. stocks are leaving investors with little tolerance for disappointment, raising the stakes ahead of a week in which two more technology and growth giants are set to report. Strong reports from Microsoft and Google parent Alphabet on Thursday helped propel the Standard & Poor's 500 to its biggest week gain since early November, following its first 5% pullback of the year. The S&P 500 is up about 7% in 2024 and some 24% since late October. But investors punished a disappointing forecast from Meta Platforms. The Facebook parent stock tumbled over 10% on Thursday after its report. A sales warning saw shares of industrial bellwether Caterpillar fall 7%. More broadly, S&P 500 companies that have topped analysts' earnings estimates this quarter have seen their shares outperform by a median of just 0.2%. J.P. Morgan strategist said that. By contrast, those that have missed earnings estimates have had their shares lag by a median of 4%, the biggest such underperformance for misses in at least 8 years. Earning reports have been pretty good, said Rick Meckler, a partner at Cherry Lane Investments, but anyone that's missed in any way is paying a pretty heavy price, he said. More earnings are in store in the coming week from the so-called Magnificent Seven group companies that drove markets higher this year. Amazon reports on Tuesday and Apple on Thursday. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve released its latest monetary policy statement after concluding its two-day meeting. Some believe that markets' nearly unabated run higher over the past 6 months has made investors less forgiving of earnings setbacks. The S&P 500 trades at 20 times forward earnings estimates, well above its historic average of 15.7, according to LSEG DataStream. We caution that potential earnings beats might not lead to equity upside during the results season, given that already strong equities run leading up to the earnings season and stretched positioning, the J.P. Morgan strategist said. Indeed, stock prices' reactions in the U.S. have been underwhelming so far. Shares of Tesla surged 12% earlier in the week after the company said it would introduce new models by early 2025. Some investors attributed that to bargain hunting after a painful sell-off this year, which left the bar for good news much lower. Tesla shares remain down over 30% for the year. Rising treasury yields could be another factor. Companies' projected future profits are more heavily discounted in analysts' models when bond yields rise, as investors can now get a higher return reward from risk-free government bonds. The benchmark 10-year Treasury yield hit 4.74% this year, its highest level since early November, following more evidence of stronger-than-expected inflation. Overall, however, 70% of S&P's 500 companies have topped analysts' earnings estimates for the first quarter, with earnings on pace for a 5.6% rise from the year earlier, LSEG said. Solid corporate results have grown more important as climbing treasury yields and stubborn inflation have raised uncertainty about stocks, said Chuck Carlson, chief executive officer at Horizon Investment Services. Corporate profits are, according to Carlson, coming through at a level that can provide support for the market and kind of overcome some of the wobbliness in the inflation and the interest rate environments here. Earnings could take a back seat if bond yields keep marching higher or inflation data remains stronger than expected. While investors do not expect any interest rate action from the Fed at next week's meeting, they will be listening for the central bank's insights on recent evidence of stronger than expected inflation. Expectations for interest rate cuts, which have been a key driver of the rally, have faded following signs of economic strength and sticky inflation. Futures markets on Friday showed investors pricing in just 35 basis points in rate cuts for 2024, compared to more than 150 priced in January. Earnings have been a positive, but what the market's more concerned about, I would argue, is inflation and what the Fed's going to do about it, said Scott Wren, a senior global market strategist at Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
And want to turn back to weather coverage of tornadoes in the Midwest. This is from the USA Today. At least four found dead after tornado strike Oklahoma. Millions in the path of severe weather over the weekend. Actually, this is from Reuters in the USA Today. But at least four people have died, including a four-month-old baby, and scores were injured in Oklahoma this weekend after dozens of twisters swept the U.S. southern plains, while weather alerts on Sunday put more than 7 million Americans under tornado warnings. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt on Sunday declared a disaster emergency for that state, and it freed up more money for operations. He said, definitely the most damaged since I've been governor. He said that in a town that was one of the hardest hit communities in Sulphur. He said that on Sunday afternoon as he provided an update on the fatalities and damage. He began his first term as governor in 2019. The Federal Emergency Management Agency had offered the assistance of the federal government. Storm warnings for high winds, heavy rain, and hail also were issued by the National Weather Service on Sunday for more than 47 million people stretching from East Texas north through Illinois and Wisconsin. The National Weather Service reported 38 possible twisters hit that area and that the worst of the storms rode through central Oklahoma on Saturday into early Sunday morning, spreading into northwest Texas, western Missouri, and Kansas. Earlier on Sunday, the Oklahoma Department of Emergency Management reported more than 30 people injured by tornadoes, which did destroy or damage dozens of homes. The agency says it would not complete damage assessments until storms have fully cleared in that area. More than 20,000 customers in Oklahoma were without power as of Sunday afternoon, according to PowerOutage.us.
Journalists face detention in Russia. This again from Reuters and out of Moscow. Courts in Russia placed two journalists in pretrial detention for 2 months on Saturday after state prosecutors accused them of taking part in the activities of an extremist organization founded by late opposition politician Alexei Navalny. Moscow's Basamene court said in a statement that one of the journalists, Konstantin Gabov, had prepared video and photographic material for a YouTube channel, Navalny Live, run by allies of Navalny, who died in an Arctic prison in February. It did not provide further details. A spokeswoman for the Navalny movement did not respond to a request for comment. Neither Gabov nor his lawyer could be reached for comment. Video journalist Sergei Karelin, who has in the past worked for the Associated Press, among others, and has dual citizenship with Israel, was detained in Russia's northern Murmansk region on Friday, the AP reported. AP said in a statement that it was, quote, very concerned by his detention, and added, we are seeking additional information. Karelin, like Gabov, is accused of preparing videos for the Navalny Live YouTube channel. Karelin could not be reached for comment. Gabov was shown on video footage pacing a courtroom cage with his arms folded. He has worked for various foreign and Russian news outlets in recent years, including Reuters and German broadcaster Deutsche Welle. Gabov will remain in pretrial detention until June 27, the statement released via the official Telegram channel for the Russian capital's court said. The charge both men are accused of carries a jail sentence of up to 6 years. Unverified video circulated on Telegram showed two law enforcement officers bursting into Gabov's apartment with automatic rifles, shouting at him to get on the floor. The Moscow court statement noted that Russian authorities have designated the Anti-Corruption Foundation, the organization run by Navalny's allies, which broadcasts on the YouTube channel from outside Russia, as what it calls foreign agents and as an extreme organization whose activities are outlawed inside Russia. The same statement described Gabov as a producer for the Reuters news agency. Reuters said in its own statement, quote, Gabov is a freelance journalist who in the past occasionally contributed to the Reuters news file. He does not do any work for Reuters at this time. That's the end of the quote from Reuters. Actually, Reuters goes on to say, journalists must be free to report the news in the public interest without harassment or harm wherever they are. And that, I believe, is the end of the Reuters quote. German broadcaster Deutsche Welle said in a story on its website that he had worked as its correspondent in Moscow. Deutsche Welle's press office did not reply to a request for comment. Russian media reported that during a search of his apartment, a letter dated April 11 of this year was found, which confirmed that Gabov had worked with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Current Time, that's the one name of the entity, that network, since July 1 of 2022. Prague-based RFE, which is Radio Free Europe, which is funded by the U.S. Congress and itself designated a foreign agent by Russia on the grounds that it gets foreign funding for activity Moscow deems political, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Radio Free Europe says on its website that its mission is to promote democratic values by reporting uncensored news in what it calls countries where a free press is threatened and disinformation is pervasive. Excuse me. The Russian police did not respond to a request for comment. A third journalist, Sergei Mingazov, who works for the Russian edition of Forbes, excuse me, I got a tickle in my throat. A third journalist, Sergei Mingazov, who works for the Russian edition of Forbes, was placed under house arrest on Saturday, the RIA state news agency reported. Mingazov was detained on Friday on suspicion of spreading false information about the Russian army, his magazine said on Friday. Forbes said it had been unable to contact him after his phone and computer were seized and did not say how he had pleaded. Russian authorities have banned Navalny's movement as extremist and have cast the late politician as a U.S.-backed troublemaker out to foment revolution in order to destabilize Russia. Many Russian journalists working for non-state outlets fled the country after Moscow sent troops into Ukraine in February of 2022 and introduced tough new laws which mandated jail terms for people deemed to have discredited the Russian army or to be distributing what the authorities regard as fake news about the military.
I think we're going to end the last few minutes with more 50 states. I'll start with Midwest states. Out of Chicago, Illinois, a sidewalk landmark known as the Rat Hole has now reportedly been removed after city officials deemed it to be damaged and said it needed to be replaced. In Bloomington, Indiana, a whistleblower and former safety chief at a southern Indiana military installation said that since he filed a report warning of potentially dangerous safety lapses, the U.S. Army and Navy have now retaliated against him and are torpedoing his career. Topeka, Kansas. Kansas is developing a second option for people seeking an intellectual and developmental disability support waiver. Out of Detroit, Michigan, the CEO of cannabis testing company with a lab in Michigan says that substances that could be harmful to consumers have been found in cannabis oil that's used in edibles and vape pens, and is now calling out marijuana companies for not disclosing that they're using them. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, a former diversity, equity, and inclusion manager at the University of Minnesota has now filed a lawsuit against the school after she was fired over a photo that was posted on social media that showed her in front of an Israeli flag with swastikas on it. Out of Jefferson City, Missouri, the Missouri House has now given final approval to a bill that would block Planned Parenthood or any other healthcare organization that's affiliated with abortion providers from receiving Medicaid funds. In Lincoln, Nebraska, Nebraska reinstated the voting rights of about 7,000 people who completed their felony sentences after state legislation abolishing the nation's only two-year waiting period became law. And out of Bismarck, North Dakota, a lawsuit has been filed by the North Dakota Attorney General's office against the Federal Bureau of Land Management over the agency's new methane pollution rule. And in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Oklahoma County doesn't have near the money that it needs to build a new community jail, according to cost estimates. While elected county commission, those commissioners told voters in 2022 that a new jail could be built for $260 million. But estimates put its cost today at anywhere from $610 million for a jail with 1,800 beds to $677 million for one with 2,248 beds. And I will do a couple more before turning back to Twyla. Next is Sioux Falls, South Dakota. South Dakota has more children in the foster system than families to care for them. On average, there are more than 1,000 children in the system in any given month last year, but just over 800 foster families who are licensed in the state. And finally, out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in a surprise move, the financially strapped Social Development Commission, an anti-poverty agency, has closed its doors on Friday without clear plans to reopen.
And that wraps up the 50-state briefs from the Midwest area. So let's take a look at a couple of international briefs from USA Today. This from Manila. Heat thwarting education efforts in the Philippines. Sweltering heat in the Philippines can curb farm production, disrupt water and power, and weigh on businesses. But it also takes a toll on students, hampering the Southeast Asian nation's effort to catch up to its neighbors in education. Temperatures have hit 122 degrees Fahrenheit in various regions in the Philippines as the weather phenomenon El Nino intensifies the heat, enveloping the nation in its summer months of March to May. The Philippines scores among the lowest in the world in math, science, and reading, partly because of years of inadequate remote learning during the pandemic, according to the Program for International Student Assessment and International Study of Educational Systems. It is extremely hot now. The heat burns my skin. It's not like the usual summer heat that is tolerable, said senior high school student Kirk Mahusi, who's 23 and whose education was halted during COVID-19. Thousands of schools have suspended classes due to the heat, affecting more than 3.6 million students, according to the Education Ministry data. And from Oslo, Norway's wealth fund falls short on climate ambitions, according to an NGO there. Norway's $1.6 trillion sovereign wealth fund, the world's largest, falls short on its climate ambitions by failing to back multiple shareholder proposals pushing oil companies to cut their greenhouse and gas emissions, an NGO reported report said on Monday. The fund pools the Nordic County state revenues from oil and gas production. Since 2022, its aim is for the 9,000 companies to invest in globally to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, in line with the Paris Agreement. As part of its strategy, the fund's management, Norge Bank Investment Management, has set expectations for corporate boards on climate change and votes on annual meetings. A report by Norwegian NGO Framdenen Ivarahend, which means future in our hands, shared with Reuters analyzed the fund's voting record last year on 16 climate resolutions at 9 oil majors. It found the fund supported 7 such resolutions and backed stratagems the group said were climate harmful in the remaining 9 of those 16 cases. Now, for the last 60, 90 minutes, your readers have been Nicole Tam and me, Twyla Glenn. It has been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here with today's first opinion piece is Carol.
Thank you, Jeff. This article is by Carly Pearson, written for USA Today. It's entitled New Trial for Weinstein, The Right Call. America's phones buzzed Thursday morning with news alerts about a shocking decision in a case that helped fuel the Me Too movement and changed U.S. history. A New York Court Appeals Court overturned film producer Harvey Weinstein's 2020 conviction and a 23-year sentence for sexual crimes against 3 women. The judges ordered a new trial. Weinstein will remain in prison while serving a 16-year sentence for rape in a separate case. In its opinion, the appeals court lambasted the trial court for having erroneously admitted testimony of uncharged, alleged prior sexual acts against persons other than the complainants of the underlying crimes because that testimony served no material non-propensity purpose. The court's opinion also said Weinstein's case was further prejudiced when he was cross-examined about the witness's testimony, which undermined his right to testify, and bolstered the woman's testimony while also portraying him in a highly prejudicial light. The decision is an enormous disappointment for advocates and victims of sexual violence, but for lawyers, the ruling is not a major surprise. The stakes were too high for the prosecution and the judge to take such big risks and make such big mistakes. They should have known better. It may seem logical that if so many women had stories about Harvey Weinstein's sexual abuse or harassment, then those stories should be heard in a case where he faced charges for the same type of conduct. Nevertheless, our evidence laws are not always logical. Often they are policy-based. That is especially true of character evidence. And the New York rules of evidence are clear and specific about when and how evidence of a defendant's character is admissible. Even when character evidence may be permitted under one of the Molyneux exceptions, which the prosecution tried to use during the trial, the court must use discretion to weigh the value of the testimony versus the prejudicial effect it will have on the defendant. A right to be held to account only for the crime charged. In the common law system, which is based on legal precedent, one court's decision can have far-reaching consequences. The appellate court made clear that its ruling was based on upholding the foundations of our criminal justice system in the opening paragraphs. And here's what it stated. Under our system of justice, the accused has a right to be held to account only for the crime charged, and thus allegations of prior bad acts may not be admitted against them for the sole purpose of establishing their propensity for criminality. It is our solemn duty to diligently guard these rights, regardless of the crime charged and the reputation of the accused or the pressure to convict. In general, we don't want a court system that convicts people based on testimony about allegations that they have not been charged with. It's easy to imagine all the ways that kind of an evidentiary rule could be abused, and it's too great of a risk to take. The main takeaways from the court's decision on Thursday are not really about Weinstein or even his victims. The New York ruling is much bigger than that. It's about the importance of following the letter of the law, safeguarding our constitutional right to a fair trial and the right to present a defense, no matter who the accused is or how egregious their alleged crimes are. Yet it's also about the chilling effect that this case will have on future victims of sexual violence. I worry about the aftermath for victims of sexual violence. The consequences of what happened in the trial court makes things that much harder for future victims of sexual violence to come forward to authorities. If victims have to go through the trauma of reliving their experiences and the stress and massive commitment of a criminal trial, only to have their aggressor's conviction overturned and then be forced either to watch the accused go free or go through the trial process again, then why come forward in the first place? The rule of law won Thursday. And as much as I am unhappy to see a convicted rapist get a new trial, and as much as I worry about the aftermath for victims of sexual violence, I know that it was the right decision for democracy's sake. Jeff, back to you.
Flint water crisis still hurts 10 years later. This piece by Nancy Kaffer, who is the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, where this column originally was published. By 2015, I'd been a reporter for a decade and a half, but I'd never been lied to like I was after the water crisis story broke in Flint, Michigan. Most journalists in Detroit and Lansing, the largest concentrations of reporters in the state, followed Flint only sporadically. I'd written about the Genesee County Drain Commissioner's flawed plan to create a new regional water authority, a plan developed mostly because, for reasons that still bear interrogation, the commission intended to cut out the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. I wrote about some of the problems that followed the switch after some bacterial outbreaks suggested things weren't going smoothly. In Detroit, our attention in the summer of 2015 was largely consumed with the ongoing aftermath of the 2013 municipal bankruptcy filing. the early days of the 2016 presidential campaign, and, shamefully, the latest Lansing scandal, an extramarital affair between two state lawmakers whose names few even remember. While most of Michigan wasn't paying attention, Flint's state-appointed emergency manager had signed on to the new water authority and okayed a switch to Flint River water while the new system was under construction. That happened in 2014. By that October, General Motors stopped using Flint River water in its plant there, saying it was too corrosive. Residents reported that the city's tap water was yellow, smelled, and tasted bad. But the state insisted the water tests showed everything was fine. Blood lead levels of children in Flint had elevated. Then I got a call from a longtime source who wanted to introduce me to Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, a local pediatrician and researcher who had some explosive news. Since the water switch, the blood lead levels of children in Flint had elevated, proof positive that thousands of young children had been exposed to a neurotoxin. I remember the surrealism of that phone call. When you get the first line on a big story, you wonder if you're about to feel the fool because what you thought you had just heard was too terrible to be true. Well, it was true, and the next year was powerful and frustrating in near equal measure. Powerful because of the effects of brave Flint residents to tell the truth about the endpoint of absolute systemic failure, and because of the reporting at a slew of statewide organizations. I'll never forget meeting Flint moms struggling to care for their children without tap water, or their anger and frustration at the disregard they had been subject to, or kids whose futures might be shaped by circumstances they were too young to understand. Some of those children reminded me of my son, then five. I had not think about that part too much. Frustrating because of the failures that led to the Flint water crisis that were all too clear, and none of it needed to happen. Frustrating because of the lying. State officials repeatedly tried to discredit the Flint residents. People sometimes suggest that politicians and their representatives lie often. But with notable exception or two, they don't. Sure, politicians stretch the truth, shade things to flatter themselves and their interests, but to lie outright is rare, in no small part because it's just too easy to get caught. Moral objections aside, it's just not worth it. Flint was different. As the water crisis unfolded, state officials repeatedly tried to discredit the Flint residents who wouldn't stop sounding the alarm, suggesting they were angling for new fixtures or plumbing repairs or the city or state's dime. They attacked Hannah Atisha, the pediatrician researcher whose medical center was a regional catchment for blood lead level testing in small children, and who went public with what she had learned. A state spokesman described a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency water expert as a rogue employee and a Virginia Tech scientist as some sort of flimflam artist. Hannah Atisha's data, the press secretary of then Governor Rex Snyder's, wrote in an email to me on September 24th, 2015, was spliced and diced. State officials took great pains to suggest that the decision to switch to Flint River water was made by the local elected officials who had been displaced by the appointment of an emergency manager, adopting the bizarre pretense that state-appointed emergency managers, granted sweeping unilateral authority by state law, were ineffectual rubber stampers of local decision-making. The state, the spokeswoman wrote, had severe reservations about the water switch, signing off only at the behest of the Flint City Council. Flint's council did endorse the switch, but state law grants emergency managers absolute authority, and emergency managers are appointed because state officials don't think the local elected leaders have made very good decisions. That part about severe reservations was simply untrue. Emails revealed after the crisis broke made it plain that state officials were fine with the switch, even in the face of evidence suggesting it would cost more to use river water. Well, what did their own data say? A few days after the September 24th email from Snyder's press secretary, the Detroit Free Press obtained data intended to refute Hannah Atisha's claims, showing that kids' blood lead levels were fine. There was, if you're not a math person, a very convincing chart. Presumably, they hoped we'd publish it and the world would see what the state wanted them to. And it might have worked, but for Free Press data reporter Christy Tanner. Tanner, also a statistics professor, requested additional numbers, performing her own analysis that determined the state's own data supported Hannah Atisha's research. That's what covering the Flint water crisis was like, scrambling around to establish the facts of things that were plainly true the whole time. The water was contaminated with lead. Flint residents were harmed. The state and its emergency managers were at fault. The state's effort to discredit the truth tellers and to dodge blame displayed a diligence that hadn't been present in their duty of care for Flint. I cry when I'm angry, so I cried a lot that fall. The state eventually got straight on the need to acknowledge that there was a serious problem. A fatal outbreak of Legionnaires' disease led to the criminal charges against some state officials, but didn't result in convictions of the highest-ranking members of state government, including Snyder. Flint received funding to replace its lead service lines, and the city's water has met state and federal safety for years now. But money can't fix broken trust. It's not so easy to repair the toll on Flint residents. Some may never trust tap water again, or the government. And who can blame them? The state and city opted not to treat the drinking water with an affordable mixture of chemicals called corrosion control that would have kept lead out of the water. For 16 months, state government lied to Flint, insisting the yellow, foul-tasting water coming out of residents' taps was fine. A state-appointed manager waved off residents' concerns with the underlying assumption they were compelled by some sinister motivation. A decade later, I still can't say I really understand what happened in Flint or why it happened at all. What I come back to again and again, though, is the lying. The water crisis didn't have to happen, but after it did, they didn't have to lie about it. Carol.
Thank you, Jeff. And it's now time for the sports. Excuse me. And we have what the sports are on TV today for Monday, April 29th. For hockey, National Hockey League, to be determined. ESPN and it's Dallas at Vegas at 6 p.m. ESPN, Tampa Bay at Florida. NBA basketball, 6 p.m. TNT, Boston at Miami. At 8:30 p.m. tonight, TNT, Oklahoma City at New Orleans. At 9 p.m. tonight, TNT, LA Lakers at Denver. And for baseball, we have Major League Baseball at 6:40 on FS1. It's Minnesota at Chicago. And at 8:40 p.m. on MLBN, it's Atlanta at Seattle. ESPN Plus, it's Pittsburgh at Oakland. And at MLBN. It's LA Dodgers at Arizona. And now we'll go back to Jeff.
Here's a Drake Relay story featuring high school boys track and field. Johnston's Anglo races to prom following success on Saturday. Johnston Jr. Joshua Anglo had a goal at this year's Drake Relays. Get off the field and get my butt to prom. Anglo, a 400-meter runner and a 4x400 relay anchor for the Dragons, had his relay scheduled for 5:26 p.m. on Saturday. His prom pictures with his date, Ruby Pullman, daughter of Drake women's basketball coach Allison Pullman, were scheduled for 6 p.m. That alone put together a tight window for his festivities. But to make matters worse, the weather didn't hand him any favors with another delay on Saturday evening from 4:34 to 7:05 p.m. The big dance was coming up at 8 p.m. inside Hy-Vee Hall in Des Moines. As a result, Anglo and his 4x400 team of senior Jack Wang and junior Noah Reese, both also going to the prom festivities, and sophomore Matthew Ernest were faced with a decision: dart to prom or miss out on the chance for a white champion's flag. For Anglo, that decision was easy. Gotta make the sacrifice for the flag, Anglo said. He and his 4x400 relay team took the track for the final event and heat of the Drake Relays just after 8 p.m. as the sun set. Ultimately, the Dragons 4x400 relay took sixth with a time of 3:20.56, just under 4 seconds away from taking the white flag. Coming into the relays with the eighth fastest 400 time in the state, Anglo had aspirations of competing for a white champion's flag. He took third in the 400 last year at the relays and was one of the state's fastest freshmen 2 seasons ago, shattering freshman records in his path. But on Friday, he took sixth place in his 400-meter dash and relay, albeit 2 spots better than his standing coming into the 400-meter dash. But he was disappointed in his final 100 meters as he fell back from the pack. Anglo doesn't care about his previous records, just working on getting better. Well, you can't dwell on the past, Anglo said. I'm trying to move on and keep producing and breaking records. That's been a tough task for him in his junior season, battling with a groin injury suffered during football season that kept him from wrestling this winter. At one time, the injury flared up enough that he was unsure whether he'd even be able to run track this spring. Anglo toughed it out this season, needing to do extra stretches and warm-ups to prevent aggravating his injury. His ability to compete through the pain comes from wrestling as a seventh-place finisher at 126 pounds in 2023, a sport he plans to get back into next winter when healthy again. It made me a lot more mentally tough, Anglo said. That's some hard stuff. You think about things like finishing a 400. That's the kind of stuff that takes some guts. Even the workouts and practice, wrestling really taught me how to endure pain and keep going. Considering he was powering through injuries up until this moment to try to get the white flag and prepare for a state title, missing some of that precious prom time for his team was more than worth it. He hopes to continue helping out those around him going into the future, with dreams of going into corporate law and studying at Stanford University, then later sparking a political career in hopes of making the United States more whole and welcoming community from all walks of life. Looking at the news and stuff like that, you see a lot of crazy stuff going on, Anglo said. I wish I could be someone to make a change or to have a say in this. But before he can get to all that, he danced the remainder of the night away in downtown Des Moines for prom.
Dear Abby, I am one of the younger children of 8. One sister is deceased, which leaves 7 of us to care for our father, who has had dementia since her mother passed. The four oldest are retired. The youngest three still work. I believe we should all take responsibility for our father. Two of the older siblings are my sisters. I live on the other side of the country. I still work full-time, but I take a leave for 2 months every year to care for Dad. The other 10 months of the year, my sisters take care of him. I think this should be a, quote, child thing, unquote, instead of a, quote, girl thing, unquote. If everyone did their share, no one would be overwhelmed with Dad's care. How do I get my brothers to step up? The two who are retired refuse to do anything. One is still working, but he's a teacher and off all summer. My younger brother helps when he can, but he and his wife still work full-time. They can't afford to take time off like I do. My older sisters are not in great health, and I'm afraid one or both will die because they've taken on too much responsibility. What advice can you offer? Signed, Dividing It Up, in Washington. Abby says, Dear Dividing It, there are other ways to help with caregiving than in person. One is with money. The family members who are stepping up should insist that the brothers who cannot be bothered to do their part contribute to hiring someone to care for Dad if they're unable or unwilling to step up. If they refuse and you have to go that route, an attorney might be able to convince them to do the right thing. Dear Abby, while you occasionally print letters related to breast cancer, I don't recall seeing any related to male breast cancer. I am a male breast cancer survivor. I was first diagnosed in 2008 with a recurrence in 2018, and I have been amazed by the number of people I have spoken to who don't realize the fact that it exists. Granted, breast cancer affects far fewer men than women, but it is serious, nevertheless. Every year, there is an entire month that is dedicated to breast cancer awareness, yet most of the information is aimed toward women. This means that we remind 50% of those who can get this disease that they need to be vigilant, while ignoring the other 50%. Like most conditions, if you have a family history of breast cancer, it is important to be mindful. Abby, do you agree we need to get the word out? Signed, Survivor in Ohio. Abby says, Dear Survivor, I certainly do. Male breast cancer is rare, but it does happen. It has been mentioned in my column before. Some famous men who revealed they'd had breast cancer are television host Montel Williams, Peter Criss of the rock group Kiss, and Senator Edward Brooks, who lived to the age of 95. Thank you to all of them for speaking out. Any man who knows there is a history of breast cancer in the family should mention this to his physician and take their cue from their doctor. Jeff?
Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, the 29th of April, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett, and my partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.